thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 77 of That Great Business Show, posting on the 4th of March, 2022. I'm Conal O'Moran. One of the many joys of the podcast is that we can mix it up whichever way we like. So, with that in mind, we've done something completely different this week because I'm joined today by former News Talk business editor and a very old pal of mine, Vincent Wall, to co-host this edition. Vincent Wall, welcome.
Thanks indeed, Conal. It's a delight to be here. What else would you be doing on a Thursday afternoon in early March?
And you're back broadcasting.
I am.
I thought you'd given it up.
I did. I was with News Talk early morning for the last 7 years, but the early mornings finally got to me. Lack of sleep over 7 years. So I had a lovely time, great people in News Talk, but I did resile from that in March. So it's lovely to be back in the studio with a microphone sticking into my lips. And folks, I've only learned really the main reason I am here is that Conal was stuck for a lift today to Dundrum. So I'm chauffeur and part-time presenter.
Well, let me tell you, coming up on the podcast this week, we will be talking about the future of the forecourt. As petrol or diesel turns to electricity, what will your local fuel station look like? And will that transition mean business opportunities for you? We have the boss of the Irish family-owned brand Maxol in studio. And given the way the cost of fueling the family motor has gone, you may need an inheritance to pay for a fill of fuel. Luckily, we have found you a business whose business is to find people's inheritances. And that sometimes can add up to 2 million euro or more. And as I do every week, I'll tell you to join us on our LinkedIn page where you can have a chat with us about the podcast. Some of you have suggested items for inclusion that we have acted on, so please keep them coming. Do also share the podcast with your pals in business who deserve to learn great business insights that our top-tier guests give to us each week. And all of those great business insights on the podcast are brought to you thanks to our sponsor, DeFacto Shaving Oil. Man or woman, it's the best anyone can get. Buy it right now on DeFactoShave.com. Now, I am guessing anyone living in Ireland knows the Maxol brand. It's a family business owned by the McMullen family. Reading the Maxol backstory, what struck me as really interesting is how the original founders, 100 years ago, had the foresight to get into the fuel business that was only beginning at that stage, but a business that has served them well for the last century. But what about the next century? Given how rapidly the world is switching to electric cars, what is the future for the petrol forecourt, especially if we'll be recharging our cars at home or on the street? I've often been told that fuel is only the bait to bring you into the forecourt store, where you're likely to buy convenience items like newspapers and sweets, etc. But what happens if the bait is no longer there? Well, who better to ask than the Maxol CEO himself, Brian Donaldson. Welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thank you very much indeed, Conal. What a great introduction.
Have I depressed you?
No, not at all. Look, I think business always has had to adapt. Businesses always have to be extremely agile. And as you said in the opening, look, it's a fantastic pleasure and a privilege to be CEO of a business which is 102 years old. So look, we must have been doing something right.
I do, and I'll ask the same question again about those two lads who set it up originally. Like, there couldn't have been a motor industry at that stage. It was 1922 or 23 or something like that. Yeah. They were thinking ahead. Maybe they got lucky.
I think they were very visionary in terms of what they saw happening. And really, when you go back, like, the business really was incorporated in 1920. So really over a very short period of time, you know, they obviously spotted the internal combustion engine vehicle was going to be the future. And that's what was going to drive change. That was what's going to drive growth in the economy. And that was what was going to grow wealth in terms of Ireland. But look, in the last 102 years, there's been many challenges. We've had many world wars, two world wars. And there's been many, many challenges to overcome. And I suppose, you know, William McMullen, the founder, along with his brother, you know, really what they saw, what they visualized today is very different to when they started from very humble beginnings. But isn't that a nice thing to be part of a business? Now fourth generation McMullen's in the business, sitting on the board and actually giving that direction.
And I went back to look at the prehistory, and I didn't realize, but I do remember, the Mex brand. That belonged to the Maxwells.
It did. It did indeed. And I think the Maxwell name was born out. It was sort of developed and came to the fore, really, in the mid-1960s. And then as the brand started to evolve on its own, Maxwell really became very prominent, really, from the 1970s onwards, Conal.
I think I've had the pleasure of interviewing you four or five times for News Talk. So it's great to see you again, Brian, in this unexpected circumstance. I think you were telling us before we went on air that you're 35 years with the Maxwell company yourself. I suspect you're not going to tell us the downsides of working for a family business. What are the upsides?
The upsides are when you work for a family business, you're involved in everything. So you don't become siloed in terms of whether you're in finance or in your marketing. I've been very fortunate in that I've had so many different roles. Yeah, when I started back in 1986, I was completely green. I came in from university after studying marketing and finance, didn't really know an awful lot. And to be quite honest,
who does when they leave university?
There was a few good things I was good at, which was partying and socializing, but that doesn't really get you very far. But I feel very fortunate, to have actually had the opportunity to sort of develop a career and to work directly with the family. From early days in 1986, whenever I started, the world was a very different place. And Northern Ireland was a very challenging place where I first started working for Maxwell. And that was really in the height of the Troubles. We were running a business in Northern Ireland. At that stage, it wasn't an all-Ireland structure. Northern Ireland was Maxwell Oil. It had its own dedicated management team. The market was very different and very distinctly different to what was really in the south of Ireland at that time. And it was, I didn't know my counterparts. Yeah, very much so, very much so. So,
and why was the structure changed?
Well, I had the privilege of working for our group general manager at that stage, who was Tom Noonan.
I think
we all remember
a
Tom.
A gentleman?
Yeah, so really it was Tom's vision that, the marketplace was always very competitive. It was becoming much more competitive with a lot of international, multinational investment coming into Ireland. And his view was that an independent can only survive if you've got a really low-cost operating structure, but also you have one team operating the business on the island of Ireland. And you can imagine at that stage, there wasn't the peace process. You still had all of this political unrest. And it was pretty brave and it was pretty visionary to actually bring the two teams together.
And is it fair to say that, notwithstanding the wider political situation, which was different, thankfully, to now, bringing two separate management teams, each with their own turf, so to speak, must have been a bit difficult as well, was it?
It was. And to be fair to Tom and his deputy, who was Paul Cran, they worked hard at bringing the two teams together. And the Ballymascanlan Hotel, which is probably well known to many of us, in fact, that's where the peace talks were brokered at one stage.
I think it's up for sale at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. It's owned by the Quinn family. So that really became our base in terms of how we looked at how are we going to integrate this business? How are we going to take best practice to what we do from our Dublin head office, put that into the Northern Ireland market and vice versa? What do we do well in the north to bring that into the southern market?
Was there a difference? I'm always curious. Is that our practices different? Are people buying different things in different jurisdictions or even in different parts of the country?
Yes, very much so.
Such as?
Well, even today, let me take you, in the Republic, we're very proud to have developed our own shop brand. We specialize very much in terms of our Rosa coffee brand, which we launched in 2018. And we also have our own deli brand and so forth under Maxwell. But in Northern Ireland, we don't trade under Maxwell store or Maxwell shop. We partner with Spar. And again, that's just looking at the market, differences, because Northern Ireland, with bigger box stores, bigger competition where you've got Asda's, you've Sainsbury's, you've Tesco's. And for us to be able to compete, we need to have the strength of that sort of large symbol store. And no doubt we'll talk later about how we've navigated COVID and the challenges that we find in either market. But one shoe doesn't fit all, and that's always been our strategy. You need to look at regional differences. Another example, Conal, is the type of coffee that we sell in the southern market is a stronger, darker roast because people like a stronger a stronger coffee.
Isn't that curious?
In Northern Ireland, they wouldn't buy it. And I
wishy-washy.
Yeah, they like a milkier coffee, a more Canadian type based coffee. So it's more like a medium roast. So that's how you've always got to be able to know your customers and know what type of products that they want to buy. And I know because I made a few mistakes trying to bring in different concepts from either market and sometimes failing.
And does the grade of coffee actually weaken slowly as you travel, say, from Dundalk to Newry?
Yes.
Or is this a hard and fast line where tastes change?
It shocked me. Yeah. It really did.
Is that because... You know, both jurisdictions, people were used to getting their coffee through large retail. They got used to whatever they were served down through the years.
Yes, but I think, you know, it's like anything in life. You know, it's what people get used to. Mm. If you try to force something on people, they'll resist it and they'll go where they can get what they want. And like coffee is a pretty simplistic example of that. But it's a massive footfall driver and you've got to get that.
And a big fat margin on it as well.
Thankfully so.
Because your business is an exceptionally tight business for margin. Like there's nothing at all, am I right, on fuel?
Fuel is very much, it's what we call front of house. Front of house because it's a distressed purchase. It's not a pleasurable purchase because, you know, it's an expensive commodity that people need, you know, for their mobility. But it's almost like the shining light in terms of directing people to what you have. But today, when we survey our customers, the reason why they call into our locations is 20% for fuel and 80% for other goods and services.
And is that the same again, Northern Ireland and in the Republic?
Very similar.
Okay.
Very similar.
Just before we leave the fuel bit, though, Brian, you know, down through the years, I think it still would be the case, by and large, people in the North drive bigger, more high-powered cars. Is that still the case? And with the tax situation, we know so much of the spend on petrol is excise tax. How do you make more of a margin on fuel in the North than the South because of the tax situation and because people tend to have bigger tanks to fill up?
No, there's absolutely no difference in terms of the typical percentage margin that you would make on fuel. And to be quite honest, you know, in terms of Northern Ireland, yes, it always had this reputation in terms of petrol heads. And those people always like to have a nice, bright, big, shiny car, and they change the car a lot more frequently than certainly their fellow colleagues in the south of Ireland. And that's still the case. Mm. But certainly, you know, driving over here today from our offices in Dublin city centre, there's a lot of very expensive, nice cars now on the roads in the all around, certainly all around Dundrum now.
What about, did you come in that Porsche of yours or was it the Bentley? I bet you I'm onto it now. I bet you he's a Porsche driver. What do you think?
I wouldn't have a clue.
When you work for a family business, I can assure you there isn't a Porsche within our fleet.
So obviously the future of the business is dependent on whatever's going to happen to fuel. So what is going to happen to fuel? It's a ICE, isn't it? It's not what they call the internal combustion engine. And the ICE, I saw there was a big, big, big announcement by Ford last night. I don't know whether you saw it, but Ford is going to spend another $55 billion going electric much sooner than anticipated. So I presume that you, Brian, are sitting there saying, we have to go electric much sooner than we anticipated.
I think, to be quite honest, look, we've been looking at mobility and the forms of energy that are going to drive vehicles into the future. You know, as a family business, we've always been sort of looking at what trends are coming down the track. And certainly, look, we're going to be going into quite a transitionary period in terms of fuels and what's going to drive vehicles. Battery electric vehicles are certainly where the next sort of 8 to 10 years will be. Because that's the chosen path, certainly by manufacturers. Manufacturers have been forced that way by legislation. They're heavily penalized if they don't get their CO2 emissions down. And that's why you're seeing the significant investment by really all of the car manufacturers on a global basis. So look, we're very much aware in terms of what's happening. Look, we have had electric chargers on our forecourts for over 10 years.
Have you?
But no one frequently uses them.
I never knew that.
Yeah, look, we would have been one of the early adopters. We would have worked very closely with ESB, eCars. So we would have had those chargers on 10 strategically located service stations on the island. And to be quite honest, the use has been pretty minimal. But look, we see what's going to happen. You know, at the moment, legislation is really driving the change in terms of ownership. And, you know, you probably have seen the figures in terms of right up to February in this, you know, in the south of Ireland. It's doubling, but it's doubling from a very low base. And really, in terms of internal combustion engine vehicles, there's around about 2 million in the south of Ireland.
And the plan is to have 1 million electric vehicles by 2030, Brian, which is extremely ambitious, the motor industry says. But realistically, you could have a situation where you have very few diesel or petrol cars, say, by within the next 15, 16 years.
Yeah, look, there's certainly going to be a paradigm shift here in terms of what type of vehicles people are going to drive. And even in terms of carpooling, it's one thing we're noticing already, particularly with the heightening rise in fuel prices because of that really unfortunate situation in Ukraine. You know, you can see that because it is getting expensive. But just going back to your earlier question, look, we have a plan in terms of what we want to provide for charging within our forecourts. But there is a lead time in terms of getting the grid to have the right capacity in the grid and making sure that you get the power to the right access points. In retail and in business, and you'll know this as well as me, Vincent, it's all about having the right location.
Mm.
The most important thing within our type of business, again, is location, location, location. And that's why we already have a plan in terms of which locations we think are the best locations where we should give priority for those early adopters. And that is largely comes down to demographics because electric vehicles are expensive.
Mm.
It's not for the average household.
So the plush suburbs would be the first to see fast charging on Maxwell forecourts?
I think so. Yeah, look, by the end of this year, we would like to have probably around about 3 to 5 dedicated EV charging hubs. And when I talk about EV charging hubs, these are where we would have a minimum of about 3 rapid chargers. These are very, very fast chargers. These are 175 kilowatt chargers. Mm-hmm. These will maybe put 80% of the charge into your battery within about 25 minutes. So we would have 3 of those, which means we could service 6 cars at any one time. But to do that, you need to have the right capacity. And there needs to be quite significant investment in reinforcement costs to be able to service that level of power.
When you say reinforcement costs, what are they?
That is really where they've got to make sure that they have a substation in which to be able to deliver that amount of power at any one time.
But 6 cars times 25 minutes each, that's a very, very slow throughput. I presume when I'm filling the car with fuel, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, whatever.
Yeah.
What do you do? What's the thinking? What can you do with those people? Are you going to sit them down and give them a 3-course meal or something? Or
I think that's a great question. And really, this is why you've got to pick the right location. Because if people are going to have to wait about 20 minutes to get an 80% charge, that's where you need to have a really smart cafe. That's where you need a really good food service offer. That's why you need to have the best coffee in the road, which we think we have with Rosa. That's why if you can do your top-up shopping, that's why we need to make sure our convenience stores have got the right fresh, ambient, chilled, and the right product lines there. But also we need to make sure it's a very nice place for people to come. And that's the other important thing too. Whenever we've already designed our EV hubs, the look and feel, the colors, lighting is very important. We have a load of ladies who use our services. And, you know, if you're sitting in your car and you're not using the facilities, or if you are using the facilities, people like to feel safe. And if you're sitting in your car for 20 minutes, you know,
given that is the likeliest, quickest charge available over the next 10 years or so, and only in some stations where the infrastructure is there, why wouldn't people, on the basis that batteries will have longer life, just fill up at home?
I think a large percentage of people will fill up at home. But one of the most interesting statistics that I picked up from the research that we have done is that 60% of households in Dublin, within the Dublin conurbation, do not have a driveway.
Including myself.
So where are they going to charge? And that's why we have got some fantastic locations in really good neighbourhood urban areas where we can make it a really great experience to come and charge your car.
But there is, and there always will be, of course, competition. If you reverse engineer what you're talking about, that you are going to put your chargers into your forecourts and then you're going to deliver your rolls of coffee, I'll mention it twice, rolls of coffee. But anybody else, say a Dunstores or a Tesco or whatever, who have already got an infrastructure, if they have a car park, are going to try to eat your lunch as well by putting the chargers in there?
Yes, look, competition will change. The type of competitors that we have today may well be very different in 5 years' time. The difference that I would say in that is we know how to look after our customers when it comes to your vehicle. And one thing which I think a lot of people don't really consider is whether you run an electric vehicle or a petrol vehicle, or a hybrid, or a hydrogen vehicle, which is where we think it's going to go, you need to wash your car. You won't get that.
That's only in the north. We don't wash our cars.
Oh, you do. I can assure you. It's very important. See, what we're looking at is it's about a holistic service that we will provide, and we will continue to provide an all-encompassing, top-quality, first-class service delivered by local people in the local community.
Can I ask a top-of-the-head question here, which I think is my purpose here this afternoon, Brian? Ultimately, forecourts are properties, and they're located in certain demographic areas, obviously. We've seen a lot of pubs in the Greater Dublin area, actually, because the pub business is under pressure in many ways, seeking to get planning permission for apartment blocks. Or like, would it? And I know it's a family business, but as part of longer-term strategy planning, given all the change that's happening in the car market, in the fuel market, the types of additional competitors that Conal mentions, do you ever look at really out-of-the-way strategic options to turn Maxol into a residential property developer?
We do have, a diversification focus and approach. But to be quite honest with you, like what we're looking at is how do we use the property portfolio which we own, and which we're in control of, and which we've invested very heavily in over the last 10 or 12 years. And what we genuinely believe is that out of the 120 properties that we own within Ireland, the majority of those will still be fit for purpose because they're in neighborhoods. They've got good walk-in business. You can still drive to those stores. You're going to have light commercial business. There's always going to be a very strong business there for your coffee, for your food service, for your convenience.
Whether people are driving or not.
And my view is this, is that if you're asking me to look into the crystal ball, what will it be like in 2030, 2035? We will still be selling liquid fuels, but there'll be advanced liquid fuels. There'll be lower carbon. There probably will be hydrogen there for HGVs.
Well, I'm going to hold you on the hydrogen question because we have to take a quick break because I want to go into that whole hydrogen thing because that is going to be a big difference as well. So let's take a quick break.
Make one small switch. Switching from shaving foam to all-natural De Facto shaving oil will give you the smoothest, softest shave ever. Switching from shaving oil to De Facto helps stop 20 million non-recyclable shaving foam cans go to landfills every year. Switching from shaving oil to De Facto will save your skin, your pocket, and your planet. DeFactoShave.com.
Small businesses often find it difficult to access the finance they need. Microfinance Ireland, the government-funded, not-for-profit lender, can help. We help businesses who've been unable to secure finance from banks or other lenders. We provide business loans, up to €25,000, to businesses of less than 10 employees with a turnover of up to €2 million. For more information, visit microfinanceireland.ie or talk to your local enterprise office. Microfinance Ireland, funding small businesses in times of recovery and opportunity.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS. That great business
show. And we are here with Brian Donaldson, who is CEO of Maxol. And just before the break there, Brian, I mentioned, or you mentioned first, hydrogen. Hydrogen could be something completely different. Discuss.
Yeah, look, personally, I see electrification and battery vehicles really as the transition away from fossil fuel. Hydrogen is a liquid fuel. It's much more environmentally friendly than the battery electric technology. And what we genuinely believe is that for heavy transport, and this is where the investment is already going in, Bamford, Joe Bamford, who acquired Wrightbus in Northern Ireland, is heavily investing in terms of hydrogen.
He's particularly for JCB, isn't he?
He is. So again, fantastic business, lots of engineering experience, and they're already putting on the ground into a lot of public sector councils, hydrogen fuel buses. And my thought process on this, and actually one of our directors, Noel McMullen, third generation family member, and he's an engineer, and his view is that hydrogen really is perhaps where we will get to in about 10 years. The investment, the technology is a little bit behind in terms of where the battery vehicle is. But if you're going to invest in creating a hydrogen product, let's say for HGVs, for aviation, for shipping, and for train heavy transport, why would that product not be brought back into the private domestic vehicle market sector? Because it's 3 minutes to fuel it, rather than waiting 20 minutes with the best intentions in terms of battery. No one really understands the battery life. How often will you have to change it? And let's be honest, the average age of a vehicle in the south of Ireland before people change it is 9 years.
That doesn't include mine, which would put the average up, I can assure you.
What infrastructure do you need for hydrogen? I mean, it is obviously volatile. All fuels are volatile. But do you have to dig deep and cover it in concrete? And so therefore, like, this is a long question. You're then going to invest into electricity, and then do you then have to rip it all out if hydrogen takes off?
No, really, in terms of when you're looking at making a setup for, let's say, an EV charging hub, it's the grid, it's the network provider, it's ESB who are going to get that cable to your site, but you're going to need a substation because of the power. Like, every EV hub will be equivalent to about 12 homes. 14 homes. So those are small developments just to have it to charge cars. And so therefore, in terms of infrastructure within our sites, it's really above ground. So no, you won't be ripping a lot out. It's just the cabling and the ducting to get that power to site, Conal, to be honest. You know, in terms of hydrogen, yes, you'll be going back to underground storage. And yes, it is a product that's volatile and it needs to have a lot of security and a lot of reinforcement to protect the product. But that's what technology is advancing. And if they're already doing it, you know, in terms of buses and coaches, because that's what you're going to start to see more and more in terms of public transport, I think, particularly if those buses have to do longer distances. And that's why hydrogen will probably push forward in terms of that particular area. You know, because the biggest challenge for car manufacturers at the moment in terms of selling battery electric vehicles is range anxiety. If I'm out, what happens if I can't recharge? We don't actually understand yet in terms of what's the impact of the weather on the battery. You know, if you're in pretty bad conditions and you have everything on in the car, obviously you're going to be using a lot more power. And in certain parts of the world, if there's very low temperatures, batteries won't survive, batteries won't work. So I think in life, it has to be a balance, is the way that we view it. We say, and we do accept, that battery electric vehicles have a big role to play in terms of mobility. probably for the next 10 years, internal combustion engine vehicles will still be here. Even if there is a million battery electric vehicles by 2030, there's still going to be 1 million internal combustion engine vehicles. They still need to get their fuel. And equally, I think hydrogen will start to play a bigger role by that time as well. So it's making sure that our forecourts are set up and you're going to need space. That's why the footprint of your site needs to be big, because you're going to have a mosaic of energies to service the different types of customer for mobility.
Can I ask you two questions about the competition in the market, Brian? One at a macro level and one at a micro level. So take the macro first. You know, you say you're a family business, fantastic story, 100 years, competing strongly. But the two big beasts you're up against here are one, an Irish multinational, Apple Green, but with access to very significant sources of capital. And of course, Circle K, a huge multinational. Like, how do you compete with them in terms of the capital needs that you require and getting that brand out in front of people? And at the micro level, are you driving from Dublin to Cork? You know, if I need petrol, I'm going to stop at the next forecourt. Now, if I thought somebody was really ripping me off on the cent per litre, I might try and drag it on for another 20 kilometres to get to the next one. But do customers really come to you because you're Maxol as distinct from Circle K, or do they just go to the next station they need because they're running out of fuel?
Well, look, that's always been our objective. How do we become Ireland's customers' first choice? And that's exactly what our competitors are trying to do in the market too. But it comes back to the basic principle, location, location, location. That is the key, most important thing in terms of our business model. And in terms of investment, we have invested as a family business from 2012 up until this moment in time, over 200 million euros within our business. And to me, that shows real commitment. It shows, you know, we're here. We're trying to deliver better services, better products, better environments for our customers to come. Our customer base has grown on back of the investment that we have brought in. But one of the biggest differences that we have, Vincent, to any of our competitors, which you have mentioned, and I won't mention them, is we don't directly manage any of our sites. We invest in local people who employ local people for the local community. That has been the backbone of our business for 102 years.
Sorry, just on that, sorry, Vincent. Does that mean that they're franchised?
Yes, they're licensees. We licensed our properties.
Never knew that, even though I would have had many conversations with Tom Noonan in the past. Yeah. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So, and are there people who own multiple sites, or sorry, who have the franchise on multiple sites as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, because our view is, and I know both of you well. I've worked with you way back in 2012, Conal.
I can't believe you work with him.
And people do business with people. Mm. And that has always been our mantra. We invest heavily, not only in terms of our independent retailers who we work with, not only in our company-owned estate, but also those dealers who own their own properties and who want our brand on their forecourt, because they see that as an advantage. They see that as bringing strength and credibility to their successful businesses, but also to the people who work with us within our business. You know, for me, one of the important things is culture and the values that a business has. So we all have difficult decisions to make, but those difficult decisions have to be made by sticking close to your values. And that's one of the advantages of a family business. We're very strict in terms of ensuring that we stay close to our values. And we don't like to lose the run of ourselves. Some people say you're a little bit conservative. Some people say we're a little bit cautious.
Conservative in what way?
In terms of not doing something extreme. We will take smaller steps rather than larger steps. And that's a cautious family approach, but it's one that stood us extremely well over the last 101, 102 years. And when you consider many people in our sector who have come and gone, like some of the biggest global players have been in Ireland, and people always said businesses such as Maxwell, owned by the McMullen family, won't be here. We are still here. And we're extremely proud to be here.
And did the big lads pull out because they couldn't make a living out of it? Or was it more strategic worldview that little old Ireland isn't worth it?
Combination of all of those factors, to be fair. And that's why, you know, we've taken our time over the 100 years to invest in the right locations. And I think what we have today is something to be extremely proud of. In 2 weeks' time, there's a delegation of 60 people coming to Ireland who are going to look, yes, some of those competitors who I won't mention, but also they're going to come to Maxwell because we're doing some very innovative, very industry-leading initiatives within our business. And for me, that makes me very proud of the people who work within our organization, but also our retailers who deliver that experience day in, day out. And hence, the last 2 years have been particularly tough, as they have not only for our business, but for many other businesses. And that makes me very, very proud.
The keenest competition, Brian, must be, because you talked about the importance of location, but to get those key service stations on the motorway network must be a real competitive race.
It is. It is. And it's something that didn't sit within our model. We like going into locations where we have got a good hinterland of people who live by you or work by you and who want to use your services, not just for when they're on the move, but in terms of fueling their lunch, their breakfast, their evening meal solution. You know, the shopping experience has changed dramatically. Whenever I started, dare I say it, in 1986, our focus was purely on volume. How many litres, how many molecules of petrol or diesel will we sell? I rarely really focus on that. I focus more at in terms of what new products can we get into our stores? What can we put into our dairy cabinets? What can we put into our food service? How can we make our washrooms better? What other facilities can we really bring in here to give us that point of difference?
And that is a perfect segue, because I did promise listeners that to find out from you of business opportunities. What is Maxwell looking for from Irish producers who might go into your dairy cabinet, who might go into your fresh bread or whatever cabinets?
Would you believe it's back down to the basic essentials? Yeah, we launched our own sort of private label range, which really focused on the high turnover items, milk. You know, that is one of the biggest reasons why people call in to get that milk. But what we are trying to move away from is just to, a lot of our competitors have cut back in terms of their range within store. We're expanding our range. The reason why we're doing that is people's working habits are changing. The hybrid model, I think, is here to stay. You know, people aren't going to be traveling into the office 5 days a week. They might be doing it two or three. So their requirements whenever they're working from home, where we have lots of very good service convenience stores and facilities, we need to make sure that range is there for them. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the average basket spend in our stores growing. But to make it grow, you need to have choice, range, and value, and you need to deliver it in a really smart, really good way. And technology has a part to play there too. One of the big game changers for me in terms of the pandemic has been the move to contactless payment. Like me, myself, was quite, you know, would I be confident just to tap and go?
Yeah.
Now it's an everyday behavior, an everyday habit. And that's how quickly behaviors change.
So what opportunities are there for Irish manufacturers to come calling on Brian Donaldson and to get their gorgeous food products or whatever products that they're producing into your stores?
Yeah, look, it's very straightforward. We partner with another great Irish business, BWG Foods. We've worked with their team for over the last 25, 26 years. And really, they supply the majority of the products that go into our stores, as do Cisco Foods, as do Musgraves, where we have a number of Centra stores. And really what we're running at the moment, we've become a member of Champion Green, which is all about encouraging buy local. You know, let's really get the domestic economy up and running again, you know, after COVID. And we're going to be running a series of competitions where we're going to give local producers who produce some fantastic products, artisan-based, very niche, the opportunity to supply into our 70, 80 stores.
That's
in
fantastic.
The south of
I love that. And when you do that, when is that going to happen?
That is going to be launched, would you believe, in the next 4 weeks.
Well, when you do launch it, and if there are winners or whatever, I'd love to have them on the podcast, because I think that's a great way to go. Whenever you go into an area, you know, Cork or somewhere. I'd love to see what's being produced there and sample it and eat it, obviously. And
Yeah, so one of the things we try to do, Conal, is make sure the quality of our ingredients is the best, but also 65 to 75% of our products are local and sourced locally. Because that's one of the values that we have as a family-owned Irish business. We want to support the domestic local economy. None of our profits go outside of Ireland. All of our investment is put back in to this island. And that's something, again, which is unique to us compared to many others within our sector.
Brian, you talked about, you know, the changes in the whole sector you're in and the new fuels coming down the line and your diversification and planning in that regard. You've also tried to diversify in terms of some of the other businesses you've got into supporting micro businesses, new businesses that have started. Two of them, unfortunately, have failed in the last 2 years, Bright Energy and EcoExpress. Has that dented you, your confidence in any way in terms of looking for other businesses in which you might diversify?
I think, to be honest, look, when you're coming in as a seed funder, and these are businesses which we weren't directly actually running or in control of, timing is everything. And I think if you're looking at the electricity sector, you know, we didn't expect COVID to be around for 2 years. Mm. And we launched and we did well. And then, unfortunately, gas prices reached a level which we just didn't see changing. And even now, when you look at this unfortunate situation in Eastern Europe with Ukraine, the level of price is there, and it's going to be there for quite a period of time. And our view was, whilst it was a sector we saw some strategic value, we didn't see it turning around anytime soon. And I've always been taught, if you're going to come out of a sector, come out quickly. Don't hang in unless you can really see a path or a way through it. We learned an awful lot from that experience, to be honest. Has it dampened our enthusiasm? No, it hasn't. It probably will make us more cautious. It'll probably make us, not jump in too quickly. I think really the focus for us as a business in the next 2 years, and we're just about to start to rewrite, re-prepare our strategic plan up to 27, we'll be focusing really on our three core businesses. You know, that's retail, it's fuel cards, it's our lubricants business. But if we see an opportunity, we will certainly give it very, very deep consideration. So, that has been disappointing. But if we hadn't have done it, we probably wouldn't have learned as much as we know today.
If this unfortunate situation, war, continues for some time, how high could the price of petrol go in the Republic?
It's something that's alarmed me quite a lot over the last really 10 days since this situation arose. And it is war, you're absolutely right. And it's horrendous. Mm. It's absolutely horrendous in this day and age to think that could actually happen. If we take this week, Vincent, whenever I looked at finished cost of product, this isn't crude oil. This is refined product that you would buy in the spot market. The price of petrol from Monday to today, to the time that I arrived in the studio here, petrol alone has gone up by 8 cents a litre. That's what it's costing us more from Monday till today. But the big shock is diesel. Mm-hmm. Diesel from Monday until what it is today is 15 pence, 15 cent a litre. That's before there's VAT or any of the other government taxes, you know? So that has really shocked me, just in terms of these black swan events that come out of the situation that's erupted, in Ukraine. So where it's going to go is anyone's guess. But clearly, look, it's only going to go one way, and that's upwards. And that's why we really would call upon the Irish government and indeed the UK government in terms of the Northern Ireland market, that they really now do need to look at the excise duty and the other taxes that they're lobbying on top of the base price, because it's going to get to a point that, it really will start to hurt households.
And apart from anything else, their excise charge is a percentage, and as the price goes up, the excise levy increases proportionately.
Absolutely. The VAT on that level is going to be quite significant. And I don't think they should be gaining from that at this moment in time.
We have, as you may know, a final question that we ask all guests. And that is, who would you hire in a heartbeat?
Very good. Okay. I wasn't aware I was going to have to answer that question.
I send an email to everybody coming on. Nobody seems to... I was going to use a bold word there. Who would you like? Just anybody at all, alive, dead, or whatever.
I'll give you an answer of two. I'll give you two answers.
You're allowed to do that.
Someone that I was very impressed with is Paul O'Connell.
Oh, yeah.
Second row.
Yeah.
Who's now the forwards coach for Ireland. He spoke at an event for us about 3 years ago, and he was absolutely superb. And if I had to explain to you why I would want Paul on my team is...
He's very big.
Yes. He'd be very good for negotiations. But apart from that, I just like his character, his personality, his determination. And always he wants to do better. And to me, that's very inspiring. And so Paul would be someone I would love to have on my team because I think he's got the right values. I think he's got the right... You know, the right inspiration. And I would say he's very much a visionary too. The second person, I suppose, is more an emotional one would be my dad, who passed away 15, 16 years ago. And the reason why I say my father is the reason why I'm working for McMullen's or for Maxell is because he encouraged me to do so.
Had any connection or any relationship with him before?
No, he knew off the McMullen's. My dad worked for Burmacastrell. For many years.
So there's oil in the family.
A little bit. And my grandparents, Grandfather Donaldson, had a garage in a town called Newton Ardson in County Down. And he sold cars.
So two generations back, you had oil in the family or fuel in the family.
So, you know, we always liked cars, vehicles. Yeah. And I can remember going down to my grandfather's place and being taught how to polish a car and to make sure it looked its best. So never frightened.
Polishes his car.
Yeah, they're different than the
North. I'm going to watch him as he goes out. It's a Porsche, I'm telling you.
No comment.
I'm on to something there. And you better give your dad your late father's name.
Terry
Donaldson. Okay.
That's nice. That's lovely.
Yeah, very nice. Brian Donaldson. Fantastic. Really interesting. Food for thought, amongst many other things. Food and Rosa Coffee. Brian Donaldson, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thank you very much indeed.
Small businesses often find it difficult to access the finance they need. Microfinance Ireland, the government-funded, not-for-profit lender, can help. We help businesses who've been unable to secure finance from banks or other lenders. We provide business loans up to €25,000 to businesses of less than 10 employees with a turnover of up to €2 million. For more information, visit microfinanceireland.ie or talk to your local enterprise office. Microfinance Ireland, funding small businesses in times of recovery and opportunity.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why DeFacto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. DeFacto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Backing great women-led businesses on every show.
That Great Business Show.
Maybe it's the child in me dreaming about finding buried treasure, but it has crossed my mind on more than one occasion how I would love to find out that my long-lost cousin in the US or wherever had left me a pot of gold. And to prove I'm not just a dreamer, Team GBS has found a company whose business it is to match people with inheritances that they probably never expected. I'm told that very occasionally, some of those inheritances can be worth some millions of euro. So there you go. Dreams can and do come true. The business we found that does this digging is Finders International. Strictly speaking, they're genealogists who specialize in probate work, and most of their work is done for solicitors and the executors of wills. Former Bank of Ireland IT project manager Maeve Mullen nowadays is director of the Dublin-based Finders International. And Maeve Mullen, you are most welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thank you very much, Conal. I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
I was hoping that you were going to bring in a big parchment showing where the family, that is the O'Moran family fortune, was.
Well, I haven't brought it with me today, but we can certainly look into that for you and have a good dig looking for it.
Come on, whet our appetites and tell us about some of the big wins that you've had. You did on the phone tell me that sometimes, rarely, but sometimes you've tipped into $2 or $3 million.
We have indeed, and I suppose dollars, I suppose, is the important word there. So American estates that we have worked on, American cases, tend to be large value. Some of them tend to be large value. And I suppose we are always trying to manage the expectation of the beneficiaries that we contact, or the potential beneficiaries that we contact, that even if an estate is worth 2 or 3 million euros, the chances are that there's probably going to be 26 or 46 cousins that are sharing that large pot of money. It's very, very unusual that there's just one or maybe two beneficiaries that share a particular estate.
The jackpot. Who hit the jackpot.
Yes, yes.
Just again, off the, this is just me now, my seedy little mind. How big was the biggest single jackpot, if I can call it that, that you can remember?
There was one case. It was a gentleman who passed away in the UK. He had been estranged from his daughter, and she lived in Dublin. And because she was the one and only heir to his estate, she took the whole pot. And it was about, I think it was about 800,000.
That'll do.
Yeah,
that'll do
for
fine.
One person.
Yeah.
Like that, it really did change that person's life, I know.
I could imagine it would.
Yeah, it did. So.
Maeve, I'm a guest presenter here today, co-presenter, so can I just bring the tone down from that seedy level of money and jackpots and everything? I'm just fascinated by it. You know, what exactly is the nature of the work you do? I know you work for solicitors, but is it to find beneficiaries of wills that can't be found, or to ascertain exactly how many beneficiaries there are? Or is it a question of finding out whether all the possible beneficiaries of a will are actually valid beneficiaries?
Yes, I suppose it's all of those three. So when somebody passes away and they have made a will, they have died testate. Mm. So the solicitor has a will to work from, and it's fine if they have a name and a current address for everybody who is a beneficiary in the will. But if people named beneficiaries in a will have passed away or have moved house and can't be located, that's when the solicitor will come to us looking for assistance to locate that person.
And how do you do so? What sort of tools do you use?
So we use online research, online databases and research, everything that's available online. And then we do in-person research in repositories also. So say in Dublin, the main repositories would be the General Register Office in Werburgh Street, Street, the National Library, the National Archives, the Registry of Deeds, the Valuation Office. We love visiting all these repositories. My colleague Lorna refers to the Registry of Deeds as her happy place. It's a fabulous Hogwarts-y.
Vincent doesn't use social media, but I saw you posting that you're delighted to get back into the National Library.
Exactly.
It's another world, Vincent.
You call these repositories.
Yes.
What sort of data is stored in these repositories that you would find useful in trying to track somebody down?
Exactly. So the General Register Office is births, deaths and marriages.
For the whole country.
So for the whole country. Civil registration started in Ireland in 1864. So every birth, death and marriage is recorded from 1864. From 1864, for the Republic of Ireland is in the, up to the present day, is in the General Register
in
Office.
In the happy place.
The Registry of Deeds is the happy place.
Sorry.
We really like Warwick Street as well.
That's fair enough. Registry of Deeds is property deeds, is it?
Registry of Deeds is all kinds of deeds. So, yes, lots of property deeds, also in days gone by, there would have been marriage license, you know, deals where...
Contracts.
You know, exactly, where a marriage was a contract between two very large, wealthy, powerful families. And the dowry might have been in where my dad is from in County Tyrone. There was a marriage deed that I contract that I was looking at one point, and the dowry was 14 town lands.
Whoa.
So one of which happened to be Formus Lower, which was my dad's town land, you know. So we love the, but to answer your question, so in Werburgh Street, that's births, deaths and marriages, bread and butter of genealogy, Registry of Deeds, our deeds. We would go to the National Archives for, the National Archives holds a myriad of different collections of records, but one thing that we visit for very regularly are probate records, grants of probate. And then in the National Library of Ireland, they have electoral rolls going back many years, and it varies between from county to county and from city to city where, you know, what run of electoral rolls they have and all that kind of thing. So
how long does this take? Talk me through. I'm hearing not hours, not days. This sounds like weeks or months of work.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just to do one.
That's to do one. But we would have, you know, lots and lots of cases in progress at the same time. So typically when a case would come in, you do your initial research and you order all of the records that you think you need for this case. And then when those records come back in, you visit wherever you need to visit, when all of that is collated, then you take a look at through all of the research and where have you gotten to with your tree now? Where are the gaps? And what else do you need to do to finish out the research? I suppose the difference between probate genealogy and regular hobby genealogy is that we need to dot the I's and cross the T's. So we need to, you know, this is going to be, our reports are going to be relied upon to distribute an estate.
You need documentary evidence.
Exactly. We need to document everything. And if there's a particular person or document that we cannot find, then we document all of our due diligence in our report, and then a solicitor can request a quote for insurance against that, stem or that person showing up and looking for that share of that estate. Yeah.
And your company is Finders International, because all you're talking about at the moment is local.
Yes.
It gets considerably more difficult, I presume, when somebody has gone, moved to Guadalajara or to Vladivostok or something.
Yes.
And yet you have to chase that down as well, do you?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So we're very lucky in that, as well as our Dublin office based on Sir John Rogerson's Quay, we have an office in London. We have an office in Edinburgh. We have a newly opened office in Sydney that everybody's putting up their hands saying, oh, I'll go and help them for a wee while.
And I didn't go there again.
Sorry, when I saw that on your website, I imagined that these were affiliates, but are these actual full offices of yours?
These are our offices, yes. So I suppose, as well as our offices, we do work with researchers and with agents in many, many, many different countries. And mainly, I suppose, the countries that a lot of our abroad overseas research would go to would be the US, Australia, New Zealand, Canada.
The Irish diaspora.
The Irish diaspora, and which is kind of like the UK diaspora as well. Yeah, exactly.
The old empire.
A bit of that. Strangely, quite a lot of Irish people went to places you wouldn't expect, like South Africa. Quite a lot of Irish people went to South Africa to work and came back again, or didn't come back again, or, you know, you see them on a passenger ship manifests to and froing. Yeah, a lot of Irish a number of Irish immigrants went to Argentina.
From Wexford in particular?
Yes.
Browns and other Wexford names in Argentina.
Yes. Which,
you see why we brought him onto the show? He knows this stuff.
And I assume, Maeve, that there are multi-generational aspects to your work sometimes. That
yes.
Connell here, who isn't deceased yet, but let's just assume he has left this mortal coil, he wills something to a named person.
Yes.
You have to go and try and find that named person.
Yes.
And when you go and find that named person, that person may be deceased and may have a direct descendant who may be a beneficiary as well. So you may have to track somebody else down as a result.
Exactly, yes. And or it may be their next of kin that you're looking for, or if they made a will, then you're following the wills. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You the chain.
Yeah.
Just methodically work through that with a fine-tooth comb, making sure that we have the exact correct line of title. Yeah.
Did you know that Maeve is a TV star?
I can see why, though.
The BBC. Didn't you work on the BBC series or a BBC series chasing down, what was it called? Generation something or? I think it's up on your website, isn't it? That's where I saw it. I watched the clip and it was fantastic. It was like an aha moment. And it was just gorgeous. You know, maybe it goes back a bit.
I haven't been on a BBC TV program. So Air Hunters is
the
Air Hunters is the TV program that Finders, our company, is very involved with.
Yeah.
And
is that on BBC?
Lots of it's on BBC, but I personally wasn't on the television on Air Hunters.
That is a brilliant program.
It is a fantastic.
That's HEIR, right? I assume.
HEIR, exactly.
Yeah, but in my case, it should have been HAIR. Moving on.
I suppose the Air Hunters program, there was a suggestion that the last time, the last series that they were recording, they were going to come to Ireland. And we had this fantastic case where the maternal side, MatPat, maternal and paternal side, were both from West Cork, from Cork MacSherry and Castletown Bear. And I was thinking, oh, this is going to be wonderful. Like, there's a fantastic graveyard on the side of a hill here overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. It'll be great from a Tourism Ireland point of view. But it didn't come to pass. I think they had enough cases to film in London without coming to Ireland. But I live in hope for...
I have two questions for you, Maeve. One is, and Colin accuses me of being a dinosaur when it comes to social media, which is kind of half true, but has social media helped your case in terms of just putting names into Google or whatever?
Yes. So sometimes if we are trying to get in touch with descendants of somebody who is deceased, and we possibly have names, you can sometimes find those people on social media. So Facebook in particular, you know, you can see people connected to other people, and like, yeah, it's limited in its use, you know. LinkedIn, possibly, you know, you might be able to find somebody, find the company that they work for through their LinkedIn profile, and then maybe you can phone that company and ask to speak to them, or ask for their email address and approach them that way. Yeah.
And given sometimes the international scale of your searches, and given that you can't be certain how long it's going to take.
Yes.
How do you bill your clients? Is it on time?
So no, it's not really on time. So there's a few different options for, so say a solicitor has research that they need us to do. We can do a quotation for that, and it would be like a straight budget quotation, and it would come out of the final distribution amount for that estate. But another option is, say if you have four siblings in a family, and three of them are in touch with each other, and one of them is not in touch with the rest of the family, went to Australia and just never phoned home or communicated again. The three siblings who are at home, so say they're due a quarter share of the estate each.
They're quietly hopeful you don't find the fourth.
They're quietly hopeful that we don't find them. But we need to find them, or find evidence of them passing away. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can't just leave that hanging there. Yeah, we do have to find them. And we can do a quotation, so that it's called an estate trust quotation, so that our fee to find that person just comes out of their share, rather than it being affecting the shares that are due to the other beneficiaries. Yeah, so we can also work on a contingency basis, which is in an instance where we'll say a solicitor has an estate that needs to be distributed. Say they have second cousins that have come to the solicitor as a client saying, I think I'm the closest kin here, but the solicitor is looking at what he knows of the tree, thinking there really could be closer relatives out there, and he can't take on that person as the administrator in good faith. Do you know what I mean? With the question mark of maybe there's closer kin. So in that instance, we can work on that research, and we ask the people, that the beneficiaries that we find, we ask them to sign our agreement. So, you know, that's a way that we can get around the fact of the solicitor not having, he can't be instructed until he knows who it is that should be instructing him, you know?
There probably isn't a straightforward answer to this. But what I'm listening to, it sounds like, first of all, it's a very time consuming. But secondly, a typical case, now you're going to tell me there's no such thing as a typical case. Is it weeks, months? Years?
I suppose a typical case would probably be two months maybe 3 months, and it would be to find one person who is not in touch with their family and they live somewhere in the UK, or they had an address for them in a Birmingham in 1976 and, you know, that street doesn't exist anymore or something like
and
that.
How do you chase that down? Just that example.
So that example, we actually had a really good... So we go searching for, I suppose, any evidence of that person at that address. We look for their marriage record for them. We look for a death record for them. We look for births of their children. You know, we gather as many pieces of the jigsaw puzzle as we can and then see what falls out of that.
And you regularly in the office go, woohoo, we've cracked the case.
We do, actually.
Do you really?
Yeah. Yes.
And what proportion of Lord Lucans are out there? Well, you just come out at a dead end.
Very occasionally, there are cases where a family genuinely dies out. Do you know that there's nobody left alive in a family who can inherit? And in that instance, that estate goes to the Irish Chief State Solicitor or the Treasury in the UK or whatever. Or, sorry, but your question is...
The situation where the family dies out,
yeah.
But is there a situation where somebody literally just disappears off the map and you can't trace them?
Yes, and that can happen with somebody who has a not unusual name at all. So let's say John Smith goes to America, or even Patrick Murphy going to America. Like, you know, if they're not using their correct date of birth, possibly, then that is trying to prove that it's the correct person. You know, we can't just find somebody with the right name. They have to be the right name with the right date. They have to be the right person, you know, with the right parents and grandparents and et cetera.
And we started off by saying this is a business. It's a fascinating business, actually. You make a living out of it. Now, we're never so crass as asking about pounds, shillings and pence on this podcast. But is it an expensive business for a solicitor or a family or whatever to use your services? That's a very gentle way of asking a question.
I suppose our fees, we consider our fees very reasonable and value for money. And
are we talking about thousands or tens of thousands of euro per case?
So
that typical case that you talked about 2 months.
That typical case, I suppose it would be thousands.
Okay.
Yeah. It could be tens of thousands if it's a very, very extensive family where there's overseas research where we have to pay and like say we have to pay a researcher on the ground in Thailand. Do you know, that's expensive. So I'm going to answer your question by saying we're very good value for money because we have an awful lot of Irish solicitors using our services and very proud of our testimonials page. Do you know, if it can solve a case that is stuck and make progress where, you know, it's worthwhile to pay the fee, you know.
You're a detective, actually, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah. We like to think Miss Marple-y, kind of. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask Miss Marple, Maeve Mullen, the final question that we all ask all of our victims is, who would Maeve Mullen hire in a heartbeat?
So I had a think about this, and there were so many people that were on my list. But I am going to choose a lady that I haven't personally met, but I've heard her speak at different events. So she's Mairead Mackell of a Tarasis. Is the name of her company. She's from County Armagh. One particular talk that I went to was arranged by Dublin Chamber, you know, the way they do kind of breakfast morning meetings. And this morning meeting, there was there lots of different, it's extremely interesting, you'd love it, lots of business people chatting about their businesses. And you know, I suppose the other speakers that morning were really interesting, and they had similar, I suppose, size teams or businesses to ourselves. So we have a team of 11 in Ireland at the moment, but we're growing as well. And so they might have had, you know, 15 people or 20 people or 50 people or whatever. And Mairead Mackell started to speak, and she's really quiet spoken and a very unassuming person. You know, Ruth Scott was the host, that day. And Ruth said, and Mairead, so how many people do you have working with your company at the moment? And she said, 1,200.
Okay.
Right.
What is the actual business that you do?
So she has several businesses. So I think they're heavily into like healthcare, and they also like do renewable buildings, or like converting articulated, you know, the body of an articulated truck.
The container.
Converting the container into like a little house.
Okay.
Or, do you know,
I think you've just found us.
Another person for you to talk to.
Another victim, as we like to call them. Yeah. Mairead Mackell.
Okay, Mairead Mackell.
Yeah, she's hired. Okay.
I'd love that.
Maeve Mullen, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. And that is it from The Great Business Show, episode 77. And a huge thank you to co-host Vincent Wall for asking all those sensible, he's far more intelligent than me, and he makes me feel kind of small.
Sounds like my last guest appearance, so.
I think he's very interested. We might have him as a genealogist yet, you'd never know.
I'm in the market.
He's got a lovely voice as well, isn't he?
Yes, yeah. The two of you, yeah.
no, his one. So listen, please share, like, retweet this podcast with all of your connections on social media, and do it now, please, before you forget. It is just a click of a button for you. It's commercial success for us. And make it easy on yourself to enjoy your favorite business podcast by subscribing on your favorite podcast platform. That makes sure that Ireland's best business podcast is always on your phone or wherever. And of course, talk to us, as so many do, on that LinkedIn page that I keep referencing. Great brands like Big Red Cloud, Microfinance Ireland, Izmi, Virgin Media, Udaros na Gaeltachta already back us with their ads. They're all Team GBS approved, so please give them your commercial backing. And if your business would like to advertise on what you say is Ireland's best business podcast, do get in touch with us today. And as always, my thanks to the team here at the Dublin Podcast Studios, including today's super sound engineer, Mark McCarthy. He's a little Rice smile on himself in there. Later, Peter Rice will add some extra long whooshes to the show. Listen out for them as they help make us the world's best sounding podcast. And as always, the great business insights you hear on That Great Business Show are only made possible thanks to our sponsor, the great makers of the world's best shaving oil, De Facto. Made in Mayo, sold worldwide. And don't forget to buy Business Plus magazine, where we now have a regular column all about the podcast. So from me, Conal Moran, agus Vincent Wall, vor míle bechas agus slán tamall.